Accession number 19907, Reel 2.
Colonel Dillon, Reel 2.
The divisional commander decided after our attack on Pang Day that he might as well reinforce the situation and send some more infantry and armoured tanks down to take Pang Day again. This unfortunately resulted in a disaster and the whole force had to move back again. In the meantime, the Japanese, as was their wont, it was their tactics, had outflanked us and had on both sides, both flanks, bypassed us and had reached a place called Shui Dang, where they set up a big roadblock. The idea was that the Japanese would let through this roadblock the armoured vehicles, but then close the roadblock before the rest of the force withdrawing could join up with the armoured brigade. As far as the armoured brigade was concerned, they went through not knowing there was a roadblock at all. As soon as they'd gone through, the Japanese put vehicles and other obstructions across the road and made a pretty hefty roadblock. The roads in that part of the world were not very wide, and on each side there were monsoon ditches, fairly steep. So our vehicles were concentrated really on a narrow strip. It also meant that they couldn't get off the roads to right and to left to deploy or to get away from any Japanese fire. Result was that the whole force ran into this roadblock where there was a considerable amount of firing and a large number of casualties, added to which Japanese Zero fighters were coming down low over the road and machine gunning us. I remember one particular ghastly sight, seeing an ambulance filled with wounded. The Japanese Zero fighter came down, machine gunning the road, of course, killed the driver, ambulance came to a standstill, and one could see the back of the ambulance being opened, and these wretched chaps, some with bandages over their eyes, stumbling out and stumbling along the road, completely helpless, but they were very shortly killed afterwards by another Japanese Zero fighter which came in and machine gunned them. There were plenty of incidents like that, and it was fairly grim. We lost a lot. We lost our second in command. I remember him saying to me, get these chaps away and get them back to Prome as quickly as you can. I remember driving off the road with a friend of mine, in fact the carrier platoon commander, down into this monsoon ditch, and of course it wouldn't go up the other side. In the meantime we were being machine gunned, and in fact I think a gun was being used on us. Certainly a gun of our own fired back at this gun and shot it off the road. We then moved off into the paddy fields, which were on our right, and in the open, but managed to move across without getting shot at. But we were attacked again by Japanese Zero fighters, but there were, in these paddy fields, buns. So if the Japanese fighters came in one way, we would leap over, together with many other soldiers, on the other side of the buns, and when the fighters turned around and came back in, we jumped over on the other side. In the middle of all this, we suddenly found ourselves getting machine gunned. But this time, it was from our own tanks, who were about, I suppose, 800 yards or something like that, away from us. And we had to stand up and give signals to the tanks to stop their firing and give us support. That was a pretty hairy moment. However, we eventually got back to the area of the tanks, and in fact we had rather a moving time then, because the Padre of 7th Armoured Brigade on the road gave a service, and all those who had escaped were able to give thanks for their salvation. But that was the only time we had a service. I should say that when we started the war back in Rangoon, we had no padre. We had, amazingly enough, no doctor, no MO. We, in fact, had asked for a Anglo-Indian doctor who was practicing in a place called Sirium, where the oil fields were, near Rangoon, and he had decided to leave his family behind and put in his bit of service with us. But he couldn't stand it for much longer, and he was really not used to it at all and not really fit. So he left. So there we were, without a padre, without an MO. So this particular service was much appreciated. We then moved back to Prome. By this time we got very little equipment and not much in the way of weapons. We were deployed north, my battalion that is, were deployed north of Prome, in really what was open paddy country. There was a certain amount of cover, and I remember I put our battalion HQ in a little small copse about 400, 500 yards away from the road, which is going northwards. We'd had intelligence before that the Japanese were going to bring up guns by elephant. This is a novel piece of intelligence. However, the next morning, all of us were able to look over the paddy fields at the hills beyond, and there we could see a lot of activity. And then, lo and behold, we saw some guns being limbered up, but they'd been brought up, we saw, by tanks and not by elephant. However, it wasn't a very encouraging sight to see these Japanese on this ridge. The place was alive with them. The first thing we knew was a shell landed right in the middle of the battalion HQ and killed a number of my own battalion HQ staff. We hadn't got the equipment, we hadn't got shovels, because we'd lost everything, and so we hadn't been able to dig in, and therefore there was absolutely no point in staying there and being slaughtered. So we withdrew as best we could to the road for a move back north again. One of our companies had in fact taken it upon itself to be rear guard on the road, and so they were withdrawn, and eventually other regiments appeared, and the Gurkhas, and we were able to move back again in vehicles. After that, we were told to go back to Yen and Yang. Yen and Yang was the major oil field in Burma. We took quite a long time to get back there, and we passed an airfield with aircraft that had been badly damaged. On our way to Yen and Yang, a lot of which was done by marching, we suddenly saw on one of our flanks a whole host of what appeared to be Japanese advancing towards us. So we took up fire positions, and just at the last moment we realized they weren't Japanese, they were Chinese. We couldn't speak Chinese and they couldn't speak English, but somehow we made ourselves understood. They went on their way and we went on our way to Yenanyang. Yenanyang was a horrid sight, really, in many ways. This great big oil field with derricks making a sort of skeletal picture, and bungalows vacated by the oil companies staff, children's toys still in the bungalows, beds still unmade, food on tables. And so from our point of view, this was a good thing. It was a terrible sight, though. And one thought of all those people who'd been evacuated in a hurry. But it meant, as far as we were concerned and the soldiers were concerned, they had at least an opportunity to lie on a bed or lie on the floor and have some water and some food. And in fact, the QM had gone to the local club and ransacked the place, produced a whole lot of beer for the troops, which was greatly appreciated. And he also produced some green chartreuse, which were all drinks, wasn't very much appreciated at the time. But anyway, we were able to reorganize ourselves there a bit, and the QM had got some more clothing and equipment, and so we were refreshed until the Japanese arrived. And we'd been told by Alexander, that General Alexander, that we would have to hold on to Yenanyang for as long as we could. Yenanyang, the battle for Yenanyang was extremely muddled, and we, as a battalion, got split up. And it was very difficult to know what was happening. I remember, as adjutant, getting a message from one of our officers, Captain Bradford, saying that he couldn't last out any longer unless he got reinforcements and ammunition. So I didn't know really what to do because I hadn't got any. But I went along, and when I got there, I found nothing at all. He'd gone. And what had happened is a number of units and subunits had made their way back, having been attacked by the Japanese, towards the Irrawaddy. Quite what they were going to do at the Irrawaddy, I don't know, but certainly on the banks of the Irrawaddy, they'd been attacked by Japanese, and a lot of people were killed, including this chap, Captain Johnson, who did so well at Le Padan, and our mess sergeant, Sergeant Ransom, who had done a tremendous amount of good work in keeping up the morale of people like the CO and so on by producing whiskey and so on from nowhere at all. I think it was about that time that we had a visit from, or might have been before that, a visit from General Joe Vinegar Stillwell. And he was not very polite to us because we didn't have an awful lot of food at that particular time. This was before Yenanyang. But we tried to lay on something for him. So Sergeant Ransom had managed to produce, by purchase from one of the local villages, some suckling pigs and a limited amount of liquor as well. So we entertained him with this good food, and to his horror, Sergeant Ransom observed General Joe Vinegar consuming a hefty portion of the whiskey bottle, almost the last remaining one. So we didn't think much of that. But then what put the tin hat on is General Vinegar went back to divisional headquarters and told the divisional commander, the trouble with those Gloucesters is they eat too well. which we thought was pretty uncivil, really. And in any case, the CEO said, well, if we eat well, that's we're the better for it and can fight better. But that's a side issue. But Yen and Yang itself was chaotic. There was one place which was vital. It was the place called the Pin Chong. And I remember when eventually the order was given to abandon Yen and Yang, the tanks pulled away with wounded, goodness knows what pile on top of them. We made our way back to this place called Pin Chong, and I remember the sight of mules and horses and men wallowing in the water, because one of the things we suffered from during the campaign was lack of water, although we were fairly near the Irrawaddy, but not so near that we could use it. And everybody plunged into the Pin Chong to get water, horse, mules, rolling, and so on. And at that time also, the Chinese were beginning to appear. So it was really quite a muddle of animals, soldiers, Chinese, our lot. And at the same time, the Japanese pushing home their assaults. And so really, when we left Yen and Yang, we left the place utterly ablaze, because the orders for blowing up the airfield would be given just in time, and there was a very gallant chap called Mr. Forster, who I presume was a BOC, Burma Oil Company employee, had arranged for the blowing up of the oil fields, and he'd asked us to produce some soldiers to help. Well, I never realized that blowing up an oil field was so complicated, but it was a heck of a business, putting the explosives in the right place. And some of our soldiers went around with sledgehammers doing what damage they possibly could. But anyway, eventually the whole place was ablaze, and all what you might call derricks and skeletal remains of the oil field all came crumbling down. Enormous great flames leaping up into the air, black smoke blotting out the sun. It really was quite a sight. And that was the destruction of the Yen and Yang oil fields. We were engaged in further operations after Yen and Yang. The CO had been wounded at Shui Dang, and it was decided that he really should go to hospital. In fact, he was ordered by the divisional commander to go to hospital and get it seen to. I, too, was suffering at that particular time from dysentery. Most soldiers were suffering from something, because our rations were very limited and the food wasn't particularly good. And sometimes I regret to say we were drinking water which hadn't been purified, although the engineers tried to, with their pumps, tried to get water to the soldiers. Very often we were without. Anyway, when he came back again, which was a few days later, I thought that my condition really wasn't very good indeed, nor did the doctors. And so when he came back again, I might say that because of the casualties and so on, there weren't very many of us there. And so it was either a question of the CO or myself being there at Battalion HQ, because there were very few officers left. And so when he came back, I reported myself to the medical people, and they said, well, this is no good. So I was ordered to be evacuated by air, which I did from Shui Bo. This was about 3 or 4 days before the end of the campaign. So I didn't have to march out of Burma through Assam, which some of my friends and soldiers did. which was pretty grim, and they had not a very nice time. As far as I was concerned, I was evacuated to Calcutta to hospital. Next thing I knew, really, was that my wife-to-be appeared in Calcutta and said to me, "Hello."
Did it take you very long to recover back in India?
Oh, that's it. Well, I was sent on sick leave. I mean, a lot of people sent on. Let me see, just try and think. It did take a bit of time, and I had to go on sick leave. I simply can't remember how long it did take.
Where were you?
I think 2 or 3 months.
Where did you spend that time?
Well, I know we went on leave to Simla, which is a hill station to Delhi, as you know. I don't think I particularly want to mention all that. And we had a fine old time, because I was about to marry this one, you see. And I did get married. When did I get married? On the 11th of November, 1942. And we'd finished in Burma in April, 42. May, June, July, August. I did various silly staff jobs and so on, filling in time, which I don't really want to talk about. Nobody wants to talk about being on the staff, do they? then the only other thing that happened, this is nothing to do with this stuff. For some extraordinary reason, young as I was... What is General O'Connor? There's nothing to say. General O'Connor of desert fame. You've probably heard of him from other people. He, for some extraordinary reason, said to me that you ought to go to the staff college, Quetta. And so at a very young age, I went and did my career no harm at all. Going to staff college. I wouldn't want to say all that, because now you do the fighting.
But did you get back into active service in the rest of the Second World War?
No.
What about after the Second World War? You weren't in Korea with the Gloucesters, were
you? No, I wasn't. I was about to become a parachutist, like Peter Verwel. But unfortunately, the parachute boys said, "Your knee's a bit dicey." I had a bad knee. Incidentally, I'd had that knee looked after in Rangoon by a gentleman by the name of Kondo, who was a Japanese spy. Anyway, that's neither here nor there. They said you must have your knee fixed up, so I went to hospital and it wasn't fixed up. In fact, I had the kneecap removed in the end, so I couldn't become a parachutist. So this was at the time of career. And I was hobbling about, and so I didn't go there. With my friend Tony Farrell-Hockley, have you met up with him?
I've spoken to him on the phone, but I've never actually met him.
Yeah.
Now, can I go back to something you said earlier, if you would explain in more detail something you talked about, which was, you were talking about these white Russians at Mingla Don. I understand that they actually joined your battalion, did they?
Yes.
Many of them?
No. I can't remember, but I think there are not more than 6 or 7. And how we managed... they might have been spies, mightn't they? Might have been anybody. But somehow they were there. And they were a very tough lot, indeed. They, as I say, did not like the Japanese one little bit. And they were anxious to get at them. That's why they came along with us. I don't know what they were. They weren't soldiers. I think they were probably engineers of some kind. And I dare say something had happened in China which didn't make the Japanese too popular, like something to do with their families or something like that. I never found out. They just appeared.
I don't suppose that you remember the names of any of them.
Well, I do remember. I remember my chap was called Videnski, and the chap who got the military medal was Filatov. I can spell them for you. Do you want to know?
No, I think I can spell them. And what were their personal qualities?
Are you recording this?
Yes.
Oh, I see. I beg your pardon. What were their qualities?
Yes. Can you describe them as people?
Well, they were very polite. You could see they were very tough. Educated and very useful indeed. As I say, my own driver, when I was intelligence officer, was a chap called Vedensky. He must have been highly trained mechanic because he managed to put together a number of vehicles that had been abandoned by the Chinese on their way up to the Burma Road. Because the Chinese just abandoned the vehicles, they didn't work properly, by the side of the road and then went on. Many of us, the vehicle that these Russians, Vedensky in particular, was able to put in running order. So they were extremely useful, very tough, and as I say, very brave. And they were good chaps to have on your side.
What ranks did they have?
Nothing. Private soldiers. That's why we made them. But how we... From the security point of view, I don't know. Really, they just appeared. And equally, they disappeared. At some stage. And we never saw them again.
They didn't get into India?
Well, I don't know. I simply don't know. Filatov, for example, and I think probably it applies to them all, was badly wounded. He was wounded twice, and he must have been evacuated to the medical chain back again to India. But I have actually written in this book, I won't bore you with it, the mortar platoon commander was a chap called Christensen, who was badly wounded in the leg, and he gives an account there of his experience as a wounded chap being evacuated. It was a long and hairy story. He was not evacuated by air. I can't remember the details, but I could easily refer to the account here, which he wrote.